Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 19th, 2006. Today's presentation is titled, Why Did Luther Burn the Books? Presented by John Wallace, number WA-JO 2006-03. Let's listen in.
I talk so much. I had a lot of things going on, and you know, I just get going, and that's how it went. It looks like I drove people away. I hope I didn't do that.
It's hunger. It's not hunger.
Oh, it's dinner. That's right. I forgot. It's 4:45, isn't it?
Yes. You don't have people coming in with burritos.
Yeah, with burritos. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Okay, great. I feel better. About that. What I want to do a little bit is William here? William was here after when I walked out yesterday. Asked me something about Pope Gregory and. You know, unlike on Monday when I left you something to think about, what I ended up thinking about when I left was that maybe I ought to explain what I said yesterday a little better and or a little more succinctness. Because that's kind of what William asked me to do as I was leaving. What was going on with Gregory? Yesterday we talked about two dates that were important, 1075 and the investiture crisis, right? And this is when... The Pope sort of asserted control not only over the states in the sense that he wanted to appoint the bishops and the archbishops, but he asserted control over the church. Okay? In Ron's comment about the monasteries, there was a strong connection between the monastic movement, which was trying to clean up the church, right, get rid of these corrupt church officials, particularly through simony, which was the sale of office, and to get rid of this program of proprietary churches where the local lay lord in essence owned the church and appointed the person, whether it was a community church or a metropolitan see. Now, that battle, really, and the heart of the investiture crisis is over who gets to appoint the bishops. That's the simplest way to put it, although it obviously has much more complicated dimensions. Now, we've been talking about the natural state. We've been talking about the John and Don formation of the powerful people that by having a coalition of two powerful individuals who own everybody else, in essence, that you can create an economic and political entity which is capable of limiting violence. Not eliminating it. John and Don are still heavily armed, violent individuals. Okay, and yesterday, we expanded the Don and John state to the Don, John, Carol, Bob, Carol, Ted, and Alice, you know, Peter, Paul, Mary state, which was a larger group of people that perhaps had multiple violent individuals or military individuals. And also, as Dan, who's not here yet, I hope is coming, made a great point yesterday when he asked this question about what about the religious elements in this, that the coalition that dominates is not just military guys, that you want the priests, that you want the traders, that you want the educators, right? You want the elites of the population to control valuable activities and to generate rents, to generate above normal return. I'm using economics words now. You know, and one of the Lunds will say, oh, use this word, I don't know about that. Okay, means they made more money than they otherwise would have. Or they got more power, and they had more stuff than they otherwise would have, and they only got to keep the more stuff if the current regime stayed in power. So they had a strong incentive to support the current regime, and it's that strong set of incentives that makes this whole arrangement incentive compatible. That is, all the major players have an incentive to participate in it. When things change a little bit, and John and Don get on a separate page and start fighting each other, so the war breaks out, we get anarchy, we get a lot of violence, and we have it. I was just talking about you in glowing terms, which you said yesterday. Yes. I was, wasn't I?
Yeah.
Yes, okay, great. So, what is the investiture crisis about? It's about who gets to name the religious people who are key players in the dominant coalition. Bottom line. Okay? If you're a bishop, you make lots of rents. your labor and your intelligence returns you far more than it could in any other occupation. Okay? So that these guys, because they're literate and they're in communication with one another, we talked about how they provide sort of a back administrative backbone for the governments. And the governments that have arisen, which aren't quite nation states, certainly in 1075, are using that administrative mechanism of the church to run their natural states, that to keep people in contact with one another. And so this is about the very core of who gets to put the coalition together and who's going to be in and who's going to be out. Okay? So when Gregory asserts this authority, it's going to cause a clear crisis. And how does Gregory justify what he does? He brings in the lawyers, right? He goes back to the Justinian Code and he begins to develop the canon law. Gratian brings out his method for resolving discordances in the law in 1140. And we're going to get the University of Bologna, the University of Paris, which will have law faculties. And Steve will be a direct descendant of these guys, although Luther's really not going to like them. As we're going to see in a few minutes, Gregory says, I'm obeying the law. I'm providing order. That's why you ought to let me establish a pan-European natural state. Okay? Now, as soon as he makes that claim, he's got to have armies. Right? He can't just be if he's going to be the head of this thing, he can't just be a religious leader. He's got to be a military player, and of course that's exactly what he does. Now, in the papacy expands its power, it becomes a major European player, both militarily and diplomatically. The papacy has ups and downs, just like all of the kingdoms have ups and downs over the next 300 years. There is, Paul! Okay, Paul was giving me a bad time about getting the date wrong. In 1307, Pope Clement goes to Avignon, because Pope Boniface XIII has been attacked by the French king. The French king actually sends troops and they seize the Pope. And they tell the Pope, we want you to do all these things. And the Pope says, no, just kill me. And they say, well, we don't want a dead Pope on our hands. And so it causes this big crisis. And Clement moves to Avignon. This is not the Clement who gets elected in 1378. The end of the return of the Pope to Rome ends up producing not because he returns to Rome. The dual election of the Council of Cardinals in 1378 is what creates the schism. So the Pope, there has been popes in Avignon because of the concerns about the French, which is reflective of the popes having to balance off French, German, Norman interest in this power play game. So when we get the schism in 1378, when the Council of Cardinals elects one pope and then renounces him and elects another, and another Clement with larger number after his name goes to Avignon, and Urban stays in Rome, there then emerges a debate about what is the law say about how we should resolve this problem. Gregory pushed the law to say the Pope is infallible. The Pope is not only the head of the church, the Pope is above the law, if you will. Okay? That the law regards the body of the church, not the head. Okay? The head, God speaks, Pope's lips move, the head should make the decision. Now, what are you doing? You've got two heads. Okay? And we're kind of in a Monty Python kind of sketch here. We can't do that. The Council of Cardinals can't be depended upon. We talked about this yesterday. So what comes out of this is the conciliar movement, which is let's give the power to select the Pope and set up the rules to the council. And what happens, and I want to make sure I get the right date, even though Paul's not here because he's the only one who's probably going to get me on this, is in 1414 the Council of Constance meets, and they establish a constitution. They're clearly saying that the ultimate authority in the church is not the Pope. It's the council of the church assembled. It's the body of Christ as represented by a process of national and urban representation. Okay? Now, what will happen shortly thereafter is the popes will go back to being infallible, and councils will not play an enormous role. But what we've done there, in that, so in the first crisis. We're having a battle over who gets to pick the guys in the natural state, and the justification for that is the law. Right? In the second crisis, there's an argument about what exactly is the law, and the result of that outcome is to make it very clear what this organization of the church is structured by. Which is the third thing we talked about yesterday. If people can act together in a contractual organization, that is an organization where their agreements are enforced by somebody else, so they can enter into much more sophisticated agreements, they are much more productive. What the church is doing in that second crisis is beginning to create a structure in which the ultimate third party is who? The church assembled in council. Okay? It's not the Pope. Okay? So the Don, John, Ron, Carol, Bob, Ted, and Alice arrangements that make up this coalition, the ultimate arbiter of their agreement, right? And these guys are still purely a natural state. We're not talking about rights for everybody in any sense. Is the church assembled? Is it the church assembled as the body of Christ? No, it's the church assembled as the bishops and archbishops and the abbeys and all of the powerful players within the church who come together to collectively vote by 2/3 majority. They actually have a majority rule provision in the Council of Constance to decide what church policy will be. So they say, we're going to create a third party out of our midst. It sounds like a real constitution. Okay, it's getting to that. It turns out that the as a constitution, it doesn't work because the Pope turns out to go ahead and assert his control anyway. And in fact, I want to stop here because I'm going again. And if I don't stop, you won't have a chance to ask questions or you can make statements. You know, if Ron was here, he could ask a 12-pointed question. You know, it's great. I came to Bible study this morning. I'm coming again tomorrow. I've been feeling really bad because Steve is so organized and so clear about what he's talking about. You know, and I'm like, bing, 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 bing. But compared to Ron Vignette, I am linear. Man, I am on a program. You know, I feel really good. I feel good. You know, I feel good about that. I feel good about myself and my notes, you know, and the fact that I'm actually saying things ding, 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 instead of bing, 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 bing. Okay? So, now's your chance.
John?
Yep.
Tell again, up here.
Yep.
What's the Pope's power base at this point?
Okay, what the Pope's power base is he's essentially a territorial feudal lord, right? What Gregory makes is a power play. He says, I'm connected via the church administrative mechanism with these bishops and all these places. Paul, it was 1307 that the earlier Clement went to Avignon. It was 1378 there was the schism, and it was a later Clement that went back. I just wanted you to know.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. We were anxious about it. What happened was Gregory really is putting together, it's mobilizing the resources of the church to make it into this sort of pan-European political organization. And he's saying all these important pieces in the natural states, plural, that make up Europe, all the Don, John, Ron organizations, I, the Pope, am going to play an important role in selecting key members of those. Immediately upon doing that, he gets himself involved in wars, right? Because if you're going to play that game, you got to be able to fight. And the Pope does, okay? So it becomes his the diplomatic skill and his position and ability to command resources both militarily and economically, which is partly where the monasteries come in, then enable him to assert this power. William asked me yesterday, did Gregory succeed in this? And the answer is yes and no. Yes, the Pope became much more powerful. Did it establish a pan-European state that was purely Catholic and totally controlled by the Pope? No, right? So he became more powerful. And the church had a much greater influence in politics, but did it become a unified state under the control of the church? No, it didn't. In fact, partly because what happened was that the Pope pushing, the states pushed back. Right, so they adopt the fiscus just like Gregory had to adopt the Christus to promise that he wouldn't abstain with the property of the bishops.
Oh, okay.
Plenty of space.
What happened? Where are our landlords? Where are our princes?
Yeah.
And
in this story.
In this story, where did they come in? Are they? They're not even involved in politics.
Yes, they are. Oh, no, they're very involved in politics. In fact, the reason I'm focused, the reason, I don't want to cut you off.
No, go, go.
Okay. The reason I want to focus on the Pope and the church here at this point is that I'm trying to, we got this organization, which is a combination political economic organization, right? The natural state is one where the political system uses economics to hold the society together and to limit violence. Okay, but it's not just used, it uses everything at its disposal. It uses religion, it uses education, it uses language, it uses culture, it uses economics to hold the whole thing together. So there are no independent parts floating around out there. Okay, but organization makes it more powerful. Okay, and so what we're focusing on here is that these innovations in organization, in the story I've told you, trace from these two crises in the church. I've just identified two of them, a million possibilities. I could tell it from the state side, but in fact, I think really what's happening is that the innovation of the law, right, which is coming out of the church and Gregory's desire to legitimize what he's doing, is in fact creating immediately creates a structure that the princes can take advantage of. Right? And so they want to assert their legitimacy to rule, and they're going to do it via lawyers as well as armies. Okay? Yeah?
I just wanted to recommend, and I don't know if you've read it, but there's an incredible novel called Pillars of the Earth.
Uh-huh, I've seen it, but I haven't read it.
Which is about the building of a cathedral in 12th century England.
Uh-huh.
And it's a great read, you know, if one isn't up for reading dense nonfiction. But the thing to me that is so interesting about this novel is that the guy does a brilliant job of showing this whole interplay of politics and economics, the impact, you know, and the balance between so-called, quote, church units and state units.
Right.
And the whole way that, like, a countryside will become productive because the, you know, the guy at the cathedral, the prior, and the local lord have kind of worked out a good deal, and so suddenly the farms are growing, the quarry, and like all this good stuff is happening, and then suddenly they don't get along, and like the countryside just tanks.
Yeah.
It's just, and everybody moves out, and
the
farms all die, and they're conscripting people into their army and going around hacking everybody up. And,
No, that's
but anyway, it's great.
Okay. Don and John.
Right. It's Don and John. In fact, what I want to talk on Friday about Machiavelli and some people like that. Classic Western political theory. Classic Western political theory is out of how do you get a good natural state? How do you get a good Don John arrangement? Right? Because when you look at it's got the, you know, you got all the pieces in there. They're going to talk about the organic elements of society, right? And they have to be balanced in this contract, essentially, in this arrangement. And they know that both in the macro and the micro sense, if these things break down, everybody suffers, right? Because this, the natural state's alternative is violence and anarchy. Right? So lots of people are willing to go along with this because, in fact, you are better off if you're living in a good natural state rather than a bad one. And when we get on Friday and start talking about globalization and development, when we look around the world, we're going to see some good natural states that provide relative stability and some real bad ones. Cambodia under Pol Pot, Rwanda, Sudan right now, places where people are literally killing each other by the thousands. A good Don John arrangement would make everybody better off. Okay? So that we're going there. Okay? So now what I want to do is be able to get to the point where we can begin to bring the state into this more explicitly. Okay? Because what's part of what Luther's going to do is to say, oh, there's a kingdom of God, and there's another kingdom, and these are two separate kingdoms, guys. You, churchmen, should not be playing in the Don John game. Right? Okay, any other? And then we'll go. Okay, let's go to Luther. Let's answer the question. Why did Luther burn the books? Okay? So, in 1974, Roland Bacon, church historian from Yale, was here, who wrote Here I Stand, A Life of Martin Luther. Okay? So when I wanted to read about Luther, I really wanted to go get Roland Bacon because I knew I would have the right stuff. What happened, and I know here, believe me, I know that I'm going to not talk about Luther for very long because I'm going to screw up because I really don't know very much. Okay, so I'm gonna say a few things and hope to get out of Dodge quickly before you guys, who know collectively much more than I do, find out the mistakes. Okay. And I wish I had the date quickly at my hand. I don't. The Archbishop in Cologne burns Luther's books. They publicly burn them. And in response, Luther's friends decide to burn some books themselves. Okay. On the 10th of December, Melanchthon, on Luther's behalf, issued an invitation to the faculty and students of the university to assemble at 10 o'clock at the Elster Gate, where, in reprisal for the burning of Luther's pious and evangelical books, the impious papal constitutions, canon law, and works of scholastic theology would be given to the flames. Luther himself threw in the papal bull for good measure. Professors went home with the students saying the Te Deum and paraded about the town in a wagon with another bull affixed to a pole. Okay. So Luther publicly justified what he'd done. Why did Luther burn the books? Here's what he said. Since they had burned my books, I burned theirs. I mean, that's not very analytical. That don't get me very far. Number two, the canon law was included because it makes the Pope a god on earth. Okay? When you read the legal history of the Middle Ages, okay, the fact that Luther burned the law books explicitly upsets the legal historians. Okay? Because they're telling a story of Western civilization developing out of the law. Have you ever noticed that every field, Western civilization develops out of their field? Whether it's theology, legal history, economics, you know, it doesn't matter. You pick one, they're going to explain the rise of Western civilization by their piece. And so when Luther explicitly burns the law books, the canon law books, the books that are come out of Gregory and Gradian and the Glossator tradition, he's saying something about those guys. And he's saying, it is this law that is making the Pope a god. Now, just before that, Luther had written an essay, which he sent to Pope Leo, on the freedom of a Christian. And he says, living among the monsters of this age with whom I am now for the third year waging war, I'm compelled occasionally to look to you, Leo, most blessed father, and to think of you. Indeed, since you are occasionally regarded as the sole cause of my warfare, I cannot help thinking of you. To be sure, the undeserved raging of your godless flatterers against me has compelled me to appeal from your see to a future council. Despite the decrees of your predecessors, Pius and Julius, who, with a foolish tyranny, forbade such appeal. So Luther is making his appeal to Leo from conciliar theory. Right? That this decision about what I'm doing should be made by a council because your advisors are evil. Right? We need to get at the truth of this. Now, it's interesting. Luther plays the two bodies game. He says, I'm not so foolish as to attack one whom all people praise. He's saying he's not attacking Leo. As a matter of fact, I've always tried and will always continue not to attack even those whom the public dishonors, for I take no pleasure in the faults of any man. Since I am conscious of the beam in my own eye, I could not indeed be the first one to cast a stone at the adulteress. Okay? In other words, if we're over here in the person chair, Luther's saying, you know, I don't got any problem with you, Leo. I'm not saying you're bad. Right? I have a problem when you're sitting over here as the fiduciary administrator of the Christus. Right? I have a problem with your constitutional provision. In fact, I have truly despised your see. The Roman Curia, which, however, neither you nor anyone else can deny, is more corrupt than any Babylon or Sodom ever was, and which, as far as I can see, is characterized by completely depraved, hopeless, and notorious godlessness. Now, I feel better about Luther, too, because sometimes I worry that I get too enthusiastic. I'm nothing. I'm nothing. Leo Luther's man, he's at the top of his lungs. All the time. Okay? So Luther is, in fact, initiating his case with the Pope in the basis of the constitutional organization of the church that came out of the schism crisis. In fact, much of the early maneuvering in Luther's case is about who should hear the case. Okay? And it's going to come down to, is this a case that the secular authorities can hear? Right? This is going to be pulling back to the old late investiture crisis, which is, can the emperor hear this case and make a decision about Luther? Or must it be a church council? Luther's going to go back and forth a little bit, and I'm no expert on where these things are coming out of. But in fact, what's happening is that Luther is addressing, fundamentally, the fact that the church is part of a Don John setup. And he's saying that is corrupting the church. The justification for the Pope and the church's position in this structure is the law that these sophists, these legal scholars and theological scholars have drawn, not from the gospel, but from Justinian. Right? Let's burn those books. Let's make our church centered in the gospel, not in the code of Justinian and the papal decretals that have added to it and that justify the Pope as God. So Luther's claims, as he starts this battle, are about the same issues about how the church should be constituted and how that relates to the secular authority.
And when you're painting the kind of a larger picture of the way the Don John thing is intertwined,
yep.
I mean, Luther is arguing there, but he also gets into it
yes.
through another expression of that same system with Tetzel.
Yeah. Right. Oh, yeah. And the indulgences and the whole bit. Yeah.
I mean, that's also
right.
part of the
yes.
Don John world.
Oh, no, that is part of the Don John world. In fact, this is all about privilege. It's about the ability to... I mean, selling indulgences has got to be the ultimate economic rent, right?
You can raise money, you can wage war.
You can raise money, you can wage, but you're selling something that the consumer, you know, that costs you nothing, right? And so it you know, we're talking about return above cost, right? And if it costs you nothing, anything you get for doing it is a rent.
Yeah.
It's like why Microsoft is so rich, right? Every copy of Windows costs, I don't know, $2 to produce. The box and the CD, right, at the margin, and they're selling it for between 50 or 20 and 500 or whatever they're selling. It's rent. It's a huge rent, okay? So that indulgence is an incredible way to take advantage of a privilege and to generate revenues which can go to fight wars, could go to keep people together, to keep this coalition together, to create, and to keep all the pieces. Remember, this is not getting money to pay your coalition members off. This is creating revenue, the rights for your coalition members. It really is a Don John game. Everybody has their own source of rent. They're not employed by the Pope. They own this privilege. It's their privilege, which they don't want to give up. Right? They are rich men. It's hard for them to give that up. So, I've been having fun with my trying to find things to read. And Luther later, or earlier, I'm going to get my dates mixed up. That's the wrong book. Later, in 1523, writes a letter about the secular authority and to what extent it should be obeyed. Okay, because Luther's clearly in this position about where's the state, where's the church, where am I, what should you obey? And he talks, it's in the
dedication, which is to John, who's Duke of Saxony, Landgrave of Thuringia, Margrave of Meissen, and his gracious Lord. He talks about the confusion in what the Gospels say about not about the state, interestingly, but about how you should right wrongs. And he says in Matthew, when Christ is talking about the law, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give them your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also the second mile. Give to everyone who begs from you, and do not refuse anyone who wants to borrow from you. Right? Forget about justice. Of course, Paul in Romans 12 says, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Okay, so Luther structures his discussion of the obligation of an individual to the state in terms of justice. And he says, Christians don't need it. Unfortunately, we ain't all Christians. And even some of us who say we are maybe don't fill in all the criteria. We don't need the law, but society needs the law. Right? Without it, we're in a tooth and claw John world. And we don't want to be there. If the state requires you to take up the sword in the cause of justice, you should do it. If there is nobody, if there is no beadle, if there is no sheriff, if there is no prince to do it, and you are available, you should step in. Not for your own interest, but for society's interest, and wield the sword in justice. But you should not do it as a Christian. You should do it in the cause of justice. Now that, I won't go into, I don't even know all the subtleties and complications of this, because I can begin to see a whole lot of them immediately about the relationship between Christians and the state. Point one, should we have a corporation in a country with a repressive government? That was yesterday on the board. Should we? You know? What is our duty? I mean, a lot of what Steve's been talking about this week is that the counterpoint is we need order, right? And these corporations are a way of providing order. I'm going to talk explicitly tomorrow about how America gets the unique corporation policy that it has. And we need to facilitate that at the same time that we really need to worry about creating this power and having it go run amok. Right? And we're really worried about with the state, because we know that when we give a state a monopoly on violence, which is not the Ron John world, right? Because there's a lot of violent people in a natural state. There's Ron, there's John, there's Ted, there's Carol, there's Alice, there's Bob. There's who's ever part of this is part of it because they're threatening violence. There's always at least Ron, Don, and John. There's always at least two. If we're in a modern state where we give them the monopoly of violence, you know, how do we protect ourselves from them? I mean, so that issue is always there. And you know, so when Luther starts to talk about this, he's moving into some really hard to figure out ground. Okay. You know, the Englishman 150 years later are going to say, is it our obligation to depose a tyrant king who does not respect our rights? Right? Who violates the British Constitution? Is this not our obligation to do that? What is rendered to Caesar? Who the hell is Caesar? What do we owe him? How do we figure that out? Okay. So that the process of Luther and the Reformation, burning the books, burning the law books, does not say we throw out the law. Right? Where do we throw the law out of? What do we base the church on?
I think you said it better before. It's not the law, it's the use of secular power by the church. So where you throw it out is the law as a tool of secular interaction.
Right. Yeah. We want the church based on the gospel, not on the law. Right? We do not want the law to become an instrument by which the church runs itself and its relationships with the rest of the world. Okay? Now, that One of the real problems of the Holden Village, one of the real, not problems, one of the great creative tensions is we are kind of not part of the world up here. But we are part of the world up here, right? And how much should we disappear? How far should we remove ourselves? Now, if we think of the natural state problem, if we say that religion should be taken out of this equation, we should have religion free of government, right? What does that do to natural states? It not only weakens them, it threatens them, right? Because if we're just going to say anybody who wants to can interpret the gospel and form a church, those are potentially competing organizations, right? Are we going to allow that to happen? Is that something we should allow to happen? How do we do it? And what happens immediately in Europe when the Reformation ideas of Luther and then taken up by many other people become manifest, what happens to politics? What happens to war? It becomes religious in a way that it wasn't for most of European history. Yeah, there were some crusades and there were some things like that. Yeah, the Pope would say, there's my Catholics and the bad Catholics. I'm going to give my Catholics the papal banner. But he's not out excommunicating the people. He's playing a game of diplomacy. Now all of a sudden we're going to have religious wars. The 30 Years' War. A number of wars. Right? Within France there's going to be debates. Within England there's going to be debates. There's going to be not debates. There's going to be civil war. Several times over religion. And which religion the king should belong to. Which, you know, Henry VIII is going to get rid of the Catholic Church. He's going to take all of the Christus for himself. Right? He's going to create a new class of gentry by distributing state lands to people who will support him. There's going to be an enormously complicated interaction of state and church in the 16th and 17th century. Now, in no sense am I going to claim to give you an overarching organizing principle for that history. It's really complicated. Lots of different things are going on. What is not happening in Europe, despite all the war and all the breakdown, is we're not getting rid of this difference.
Still there, no matter what's going on.
It's yeah.
All the different wars and who's in charge. There's still that complicated thing going on.
Right. They're competing to be. There are factions in France. Every time there is a regency, that is the in king in France there can't be queens. There can only be kings. Okay. Because of I think it's the Salic law. And as a result, sometimes the kings are 2 years old or 4 years old. And every time there's a regency, meaning that there's somebody appointed to act in the benefit of the king, guess what happens? What?
The church steps in.
No, the church doesn't step in. There's civil war. Sometimes the church is involved in it because the popes are still really involved in French politics. And there's the French, there's lots of things going on. But there's a civil war. Okay? There's fighting within France. Every single time there's a regency. Okay? Which is solved then by a new coalition that says, we have this chair. We have a constitution. We have not a constitution written on a piece of paper. We have a hearty constitution. This morning, as Ron was talking about, what do you do in the morning? You go to the bathroom. I had a hearty constitutional this morning. That's what they meant by constitution. The body politic, the social body, the sinew. As John Adams would call it in 1778, the stamina vita of the society. Now, that is a tremendous accomplishment. Right? That's why Europe is special. Because when the Ottoman emperors finally get deposed, the whole empire is going to fall apart. They're saying, we have an organizational structure
which underlies how we compete within our dominant coalition. Okay? The contribution of law to this is fundamental, because we're going to say the relationships between the Pope and the bishop are going to be determined by law. It's interesting, in English law, in a sense, the king is always omnipotent. He is above the law. But in fact, he's not. Okay? That is, the process of creating a powerful organization requires identifying third parties who can settle disputes. Right? If the ultimate resolution is we go to war, that organization breaks down and everybody loses, how does a society begin to structure these relationships? By 1500 or 1700, Europe is on the verge, right, of creating a permanent structure in its society that will allow the members of the dominant coalition, and here I want to, the people at the top, the elites, may be in a position all of a sudden to start doing things with non-elite people, like sell them shares of stock in a corporation or move them to Virginia, right? Or send them to South Africa, or put them to work in a factory, right? In a way that enhances the revenue, the interest of the elite person, but are going to expand the size of the dominant coalition past the point where the Ron John solution is sustainable. Okay, now remember that the way the natural state works is by limiting access. It limits entry. You cannot have everybody in the dominant coalition, because if everybody's there, there's no rents left. And it's the rents that create the incentives that keep everybody on the same page. Okay. The society that we live in, and I would argue with evidence that I will produce in the future, that all successful modern developed economies are open access societies, not limited access societies. They're societies in which social order is provided by competition. Okay? Now, in the Don John world, competition is deadly and expensive, and you want to do everything you can to eliminate it or to keep it under wraps, because competition will ultimately break out into violence. In an open access world, like the United States, competition becomes the organizing principle for society. We have a competitive polity in a way that no medieval European government had. Right? We have a competitive economy. We have competitive religion. We have competitive retreat centers. Okay? Now, what is operative there, and I'll talk here over the next couple days about how competition produces this outcome. What enables competition is entry, is access. Okay? You cannot have a competitive religious society unless people are free to start churches. Okay? And free to build buildings, and free to borrow money. Right? You cannot have a competitive political system unless people are free to start political parties. And you don't shoot your opponent. The story is in Mexico that every serious competitor to the PRI left this world before the election in a box, dead. Okay? Now, remember the gospel on Sunday about Herod murdering his own sons? Normal politics. Normal politics in a Don John world. How is it
that in our society, we let people compete in almost every conceivable way, except for which way? What can you absolutely not do to get resources in the United States?
Kill somebody.
You cannot kill somebody. Okay? Can any corporation in the United States, Steve, use violence to get resources?
They shouldn't, they can't.
They shouldn't and they can't. Now, sometimes they may. Okay? And there, you know, there's God knows how many action movies based upon the fact that a corporation has an army operating in Nebraska or something like that. Okay? But in fact, the entire structure of the law in our system says we will support very sophisticated organizational forms like IBM, like Microsoft, like Holden Village, like the ELCA, which, believe it or not, has a charter. Right? Okay. The one thing those guys cannot do, clearly, is they cannot use violence to allocate resources, which is what the natural state is built around, the threat of being able to do that. Now, Steve has very many times said good corporate law will include regulation and that sort of thing, and there will be lots of laws, and there will be lots of things that people can and cannot do in an open access society. The law will constrain people in certain kinds of ways. What will prevent those laws from taking away people's rights? What prevents clearly the national government does take away people's rights periodically. All governments in the United States have the right of eminent domain. They can condemn your property for public purpose. But if they do that, what do they have to give you? They have to give you due process of law, which may produce compensation and will produce a judgment against it. What guarantees that and of course there's no guarantees in this world, folks. So what guarantees that the government does not simply come in and take your property, does not, like they did in Argentina, disappear you?
Constitution. Checks and balances, competition.
Okay, how many of you believe it's the Constitution and checks and balances and all those institutions? Okay, what did our Constitution do when we sent it to Bolivia? When they adopted it, lock, stock, and barrel. Yeah, it didn't work. Okay. Now, that doesn't say the Constitution isn't important, but the words written on the paper and the form of government in and of themselves were not enough. What makes our Constitution work? What did the Founding Fathers think about political parties? Does anybody know?
They weren't a fan.
What?
They weren't a fan.
They weren't a fan. They abhorred them. They were living in a Don John world where competition and factions are the most deadly thing, because as soon as Don and John start forming their own political pack, those political factions, everything breaks apart, falls down. What did we have by the election of 1800?
Federalists
and Republicans. We had political parties. You gotta watch the hoops that Thomas Jefferson goes through to not be a politician. Madison's, I think, smarter than Jefferson. He realizes it right away. Shoot, we're stuck with it. We've got to have political parties. We've got to figure out how to make this work. What guarantees our rights in America? Political competition. Because if we do not vote the suckers out, they'll get us. Right? Viable political competition is part of viable economic competition, is part of viable religious freedom. Without all those pieces working together, you cannot have a modern, developed society in which people enjoy freedoms. Now, I will be the first to admit that in the United States, as it developed this open access society, 20% of the population was in chains. So it does not take 100% open access, right? 50% of the population of the free white population couldn't vote until the beginning of the 20th century in most places. Okay. But it requires enough people to sustain competition. Now, what's the big problem that I face, or we face? How do you get from one to the other? How do we get from a natural state, Don John world, to a competitive open access economy, society? Quality.
How do we get to a world in which entry performs a lot of the policing functions, in which competition for politicians, for economics, for religious groups provides a check on how well you do things and rewards to induce you to do well?
John?
That's a hard question to ask.
Now, where did you put Luther in that series of actions? I mean, the burning the books thing.
Yeah, where's Luther? What's the world that Luther lives in?
It's a Don John world.
It's a Don John world. And what kind of states is Luther writing about? Don John's. Or he's writing about natural states, right? In other words, Luther is not seeing a modern political, religious world.
Right.
Okay?
Although Luther, by his actions, is probably one of the first persons as an individual to take on institutions.
Right. Well, no, I think people can take... He's a person, he's one of the people that are a key player in a series of changes that are going to produce an open access economy. And I say economy because I'm an economist, an open access society. Right? So Luther's playing a role there. Now, anybody got any questions? Because I just said a whole mouthful, and I introduced a whole new social order. Right? I mean, the one that we live in. It's hard when like fish don't know about water. Okay? It's hard to see that our world is unique in a fundamental way from much of history. Because we live in it. And we assume that societies work like ours work. Because all the human beings we see have this shared cultural knowledge, Jeff, right? That how the other people will behave is consistent with living in an open access society. So when we go to limited access societies, we have a lot of trouble, as Steve said, figuring out what the rules are. Because it turns out that there aren't rules like there are in ours. Dan?
Well, I mean, what I was thinking about is your comment that you made about, every field says that it's their field. They
right.
contribute. I mean, the question you just asked, I could see the same thing happening. Some people could say, well, it's the printing press.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Everybody could read, And then some people would say, well, no, it's certain new religious forms arose. And then some people would say, well, no, there's got to be a lot of things that are coming into play to contribute to the idea that, people sort of start to feel okay about the fact that everybody can think and participate. Some people say, well, it's the chartering of the East India Company.
Right.
So that was the thing that did it.
Right.
It was an economic thing.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Because, in fact, what the position I'm arguing here is that there's a fundamental transformation of the entire society. Right? So all the pieces of society have to change. So we should see changes in the organization of religion. We should see changes in the organization of politics. We should see changes in the organization of education. We should see changes in the organization of the military. We should see changes in the organization of the economy, right? And it should be pervasive, and it's going to be impossible to tell a causal story. It's going to be possible to tell millions of causal stories, actually, and it's going to be impossible to sort out between them because all this is going to happen at once. So the question is, can we,
When you ask the question about what is it that holds us together, makes it all work, the thing that I was thinking is that it's really sort of voluntary involvement. I mean, it really is a matter of a populace which understands and assumes that the way we do things is right, basically, and agrees about these things. Some of the most interesting conversations that I had in China, it's changing
right.
the worldview, being in China for
sure.
Were people very bright, some of them involved in fairly high-paying jobs, others in not high-paying jobs, really not very good circumstances, which they were aware of. And I would try to broach the subject of governmental control. And virtually everybody said, hey, it's really a good idea that we have such a strong government.
Right.
And of course, I observed some of the benefits of that.
Right.
In Chicago, there's something that says that that unions have to always be paid to build the roads, and so we're always building the roads, and we can never get where we want to go.
They have to be paid.
But in China, if we want to have a road, it's there tomorrow. It may not be to code.
Right.
But it happens in a real big hurry.
Oh yeah.
And then the people who are responsible for doing the paving come in and cut out part of what the paving you know, the road people did to put their paving in and stuff, but things do happen in the
oh, no,
and there's tremendous organization in that sense.
Yeah.
And the person on the street doesn't care that they can't demonstrate against the government. What they care about is making more money. They want to be able to have more money. They want to be able to have more things. You know, it's the things they see on TV. So
right.
I became very aware through that. That, yeah, we just have a whole different set of expectations, and we complain a lot more about some things here, but it is really part of the consciousness
yes.
that keeps 97% of the people, or at least 90% of the people on the street, walking in
right.
the right direction, driving on the right side,
right.
that kind of stuff. And that self-policing also happens in China in ways that we find horrifying. No, they're not going to try to send stuff on the internet that they
okay.
can't.
Right, but you got to be careful there. Because when we think about, and this is Jeff's territory, right? When we think about cultures and how they work, right? Let's go here. For a minute. When you're a baby and you're born, okay, you got some, you know, genetically in the high learning mode. Okay, you're going to learn languages. You can do all kinds of stuff. And you know, babies clearly aren't genetically programmed to learn Chinese. Okay, because it doesn't. You take a Chinese baby, put them in America, they'll learn English. Put them in China. On Chinese, right? Okay. And so they learn stuff like this right away, you know, gravity from their own experience. Okay. And what are the most important things? You know, they got to master like getting around. You know, that's up to age one. Then they manage talking. You know, then they manage no, and you know, the terrible twos kind of stuff. They start managing stuff, but they're really learning machines. And they learn in two fundamental ways. They experience things that they learn from themselves and they can test out. And what's the other way?
Imitating.
What?
Imitating.
No, they're taught.
They're taught.
Do you ever tell your kids anything that was going to happen to them that they couldn't see? Don't put your fork in the electrical socket. Okay, go ahead. You don't say go ahead, right? You say don't play in the street, right? Well, you know, and then at some point that becomes experience. Don't vote Republican. Don't eat high in the food chain. Don't, if you do, back to Ron's point, if you do this, then this will happen. Right? Now, we have to learn that way because we cannot experience enough people to figure out how people behave in a complicated society. If we are limited from finding out about how the people behave who live around us, how big are the organizations going to be in our society, and what kind of society are we going to have? 25, and we're going to have a hunting and gathering society. Okay? Because if our learning about the world is only our direct experience with people, that can be very limited. And in those societies, they immediately start teaching you, this is where the line is. This is where the water is. This is when the crops come back. Right? In fact, the definition of culture I gave in Jeff's first lecture was from Franz de Waal. And actually it's in The Ape and the Sushi Master, not in Chimpanzee Politics, which is culture is all the things that we teach to our children that we collectively pass on. So culture has a shared large component and has obviously, you know, regional components and it has local components and it has family components. Some of you have gotten to know my wife Ellen. We got married almost 9 years ago. We're kind of a junior Brady Bunch. She has two daughters. I have two sons. And believe me, our cultures were not shared when we moved in together. Toilet paper, right? A simple matter appears to be worlds apart. Okay. Now, we are taught, we cannot function as human beings unless we learn things that we're taught, right? And so we begin to acquire experience, and then we verify it. And we verify it by looking at the people around us, because the most important things we're taught are not physics, it's social behavior, right? And so what we're taught has got to be consistent with what we see around us, or there's going to be a real cultural problem there. So when your parents tell you something, and you see it not being verified by your experiences, you eventually learn, oh, my parents don't know anything. Now, that's partly biological, because you got to get out of the house. Your parents really want that.
Yes.
And you need this verification process. So we have this problem cognitively, is that the society we see seems to us to be governed by this kind of law.
especially if it's something that we always see because everybody sees the same behavior in all the people around them, and it's never a possibility to see that people could behave in a different way. So part of what Jeff is talking about is how do you go across cultures? How do you all of a sudden see something that you thought was a true fact isn't? It's just a manifestation of your society.
It's an agreement.
What? It's an agreement, right. And in fact, what underlies these possible complex organizations, and China is going to form organizations in a much different way than our society performs them, right, is these agreements. Adherent organizations exist of agreements only. Everybody who's part of them voluntarily agrees to do this. Complex societies need to be based on contractual agreements in which there's third parties. The problem that China was going to face is that it's getting more economic openness and it has no political openness. And those two things are fundamentally in conflict. Right? So there's plenty of, and I have a friend, a Chinese friend who I'm writing a paper with. She's from China. She goes back to China all the time. She works in the United States, but she goes back and forth. And I ask her, well, what about the Cultural Revolution? She said, oh, we don't have any more problems with that. You know, we get the best and the brightest people together in a big room and we decide what to do. Whoa. She's really smart, and she believes that that's how China runs. And I'm thinking, man, I don't want to get anybody in a room to decide what's going to happen. I want to have a vote. I want to have competition. I want to have one group over here and another group over here and another group over here. You know, I want to. Okay. So there's big problems. And we see, it must be the case that in a society that functions, that is not subject to anarchy, that people know the rules that enable them to get along. And that's true of every society, whether it's an open, limited, primitive. We understand the rules about how we interact. And those rules, very often to us, are completely unobservable to us. They're transparent to us. Because they are the laws of the world that we live in that we see as being natural, like which way the toilet paper goes, which turned out to be random at my house and ordered at Ellen's house. So part of what we have to struggle with in this explaining a transition, and that word that I use to describe this is the transition from open access, from limited access to open access societies. That, in fact, is development. The societies that have opened are rich and have political freedoms and have political and economic and religious competition, by and large, and the societies that are not developed are limited. Okay. The transition comes out of events that start happening in Europe. 1492 is my favorite date. Columbus sails the ocean blue, Gutenberg invents the printing press, the Spanish kick the Moors out of Africa, right? And over this next period, Europe is going to have this renaissance, right? This blossoming of knowledge. And so what I'll talk about the next couple days is understanding how that transition happened and how that provides the basis for the world that we live in.
All right.